Postman. Postman. P-p. Postman. 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 No, I haven't accidentally recorded myself yearning for a postman. I got myself a new... I don't want to call it fancy because it was only a tenner, but it looks fancy. A new pop shield for my microphone. I've been using a sock. I've got like a really good microphone and I've been putting a sock on it for ages so that when I speak, it doesn't offend your ears when I say a P or an S. And I just said to myself, what the fuck am I, why am I using a sock? Like, why? What's the point of that? It's cumbersome. It's sometimes, I have mild dust allergies. And occasionally when I lean my head towards the microphone and there's a sock on it, the problem with the sock is that not only does it collect dust, but because the sock was on an electrical object, I think it ionized it or something and made it collect even more dust. So there'd be times when I'd be leaning into the microphone and now my allergies are set off by a dusty sock. And I said, there's a solution to this. And the solution is to buy a thing known as a pop shield, which I generally don't like because they're cumbersome. And then I found this gorgeous little pop shield online for a tenner, which wraps around the microphone and is dainty and pretty looking. And it does what I wanted the sock to do, but way better. So there you go. That's why I said postman. If you listen to this podcast, you know that postman is the phrase that I use to test the mic. Why? Because it's got a P and an S and a T. And it's the perfect word for testing microphones. Postman. Postman. What if it's not? And I'm a time-traveling spy working for the Soviets in the 1960s. And they were able to send me into the future to 2020 Ireland. And I'm broadcasting the word postman in different tones. And they can read that in Morse code through time. What if that's what's happening? It's not. So it is very early on in the month, which I'm going to begin the first of a new tradition. If you were listening last month, you know that I want to do this new thing whereby, in order to be, as a thank you to patrons of the podcast, to people who sign up on Patreon, I was going to pick one person each month from, at random, from my patrons, and that one person is going to get a hand-drawn image that's signed in the post. So I've picked that person at random from Patreon. That person's name is Amber Maher, and Amber is going to get a drawing in the post. I'm not sure what it is yet. I don't know what the drawing will be of. Maybe a dog. A dog with Henry Cavill's head. Why not? With a speech bubble that has his piece of prose from last week. Thank you for the lovely feedback for last week's podcast, by the way. I had John and Brenda Romero speaking about the history of video games and discussing video games as art. Very enjoyable. I'm glad you liked it. It's nice to hear a live gig. It's nice to hear a live gig because fuck knows I've forgotten what a live gig feels like. So this week I want to do, like, I've started calling them companionship podcasts based on feedback that I got from ye. We're all living underneath the grasp of the goblin of strange and uncertain times. And as a result, we're in quarantine. Huge amount of time on our hands. We're tired. We're all tired and stressed. Tired from inactivity. And a lot of ye just want to hear, a lot of ye just put on the podcast to hear someone's voice, to be engaged in conversation, because we're not doing a lot of conversing with human beings right now. Because it's dangerous, the act of being in another person's physical presence and having a big long chat, unless they're immediate family. I can't remember the last time I had a chat with a stranger. 3 months ago. So that's what these podcasts are for. Other people have been telling me that their sleep patterns are fucked up. So some of you are just listening to this podcast when you're trying to go to sleep, just to have another voice present. Because it's lonely enough times right now. It's lonely enough times. It is for me anyway. I don't want to do a hot take this week, because you know that I like to provide you with a bit of escapism and distraction, and to try and not speak about current events because the news is saturated with it. But however, this week, in light of what's happening in America with the Black Lives Matter movement, with the protests against police brutality, it'd be strange and disrespectful for me to carry on and pretend that it doesn't exist. I don't think that would be appropriate. And I'm getting a lot of people asking me, Blind Boy, will you do a podcast on the protests in America and the Black Lives Matter movement? No, I won't. What you need to do is listen to the voices of black people. Listen to what black people are saying. Listen to when they say they're angry, when they say they're marginalized, when they say that they need justice. You listen with all of your ears as to why, and you believe their experience. That's what you need to do. Not me, because what the fuck do I do? What do I know? I'm not speaking from a place of experience. What I'm mainly doing online, like, I have a Twitter audience of 250,000, mostly white people, mostly Irish, so I'm using every opportunity I can to retweet black people who are speaking about this issue. So then I'm not taking up space in that conversation with something I know fucking nothing about. I'm listening, and then I'm platforming their voices and giving it a wider audience so that other people can then listen, which I think that's the appropriate thing to do. What I am comfortable speaking about is anything that will help Irish people in particular to listen better. Not to me, but to black people who are speaking about their marginalisation. Because that's a big issue I'm seeing at the moment in Ireland, that's a problem. There's loads of Irish people, right, that are concerned with what's happening in America, who are on the side of the Black Lives Matter protesters, who understand the injustice and who would like to see justice done and would like to see reform. There's plenty of Irish people like that, but there's also a lot of Irish people who view the protesters as criminals, who don't view their anger as legitimate, who are in support of the fucking police, who are being very right-wing, saying that Trump should bring in the military, would like to see violence. There's a lot of this discourse in Ireland, unfortunately. I heard it today on Joe Duffy, which is like an Irish talk show thing. Joe Duffy's a weird one. It's like this big sad nipple that everybody sucks on and gets this sour, sad milk out of. It's this strange Irish tradition, you know. It's how would you explain it? It's what got left in the whole of Catholicism. Catholicism blew apart in Ireland and we were left with this sad little lonely crater. And the Joe Duffy show filled that. It's where we go to suck this giant fucking leathery tit of shame. But there was a couple of racists on Joe Duffy. There was other people who were not racists on Joe Duffy. And I hate hearing Irish people who can't respect the marginalisation of other people. It really bothers me because the same people, like, if you grow up in Ireland, the Irish identity is very post-colonial, okay? From an incredibly young age, you learn that the Irish people were oppressed for 800 years by the British Empire, and we experienced all the horrors of the earth, right? That's part of your identity growing up. It's post-colonial identity. And, you know, I never experienced marginalisation. I grew up with the privilege of being in the Free State of Ireland with no fucking 26 counties, no British soldiers. But you learn about your grandfather, your great-grandfather, your great-great-grandfather, your great-great-grandmother, and the horrors that they've been through, and how this is drilled into you from birth. This is what it means to be Irish. Don't ever forget it. don't ever forget the pain that was thrown upon you. And everyone's brought up with this, and then there's still a huge amount of Irish people who will start weeping when they think about the famine, but at the same time will shout down a black person or a black Irish person if they speak about their marginalisation. And it really bothers me, because I'm not excusing like Spanish, French and English people, because they're, you know, they come from a culture whereby they were the colonisers, and they don't know what it's like to have a history whereby they experience systemic oppression. But we actually have that history in our identity, so we've less of an excuse to be shouting over people when they're just simply asking to be listened to, when they simply say, I am hurting under a system which appears to be designed to hurt me. So that's where I see, ethically, see my place, and ethically feel comfortable using my voice around anything to do with the protests in America. I feel comfortable using my voice when I'm trying to compassionately get other Irish people to engage more with empathy so that they can listen to black people. That role sits comfortably like a little sandwich in my moral lunchbox. And I tried to do it today. I tried to do that today online on Twitter, because I came across a story, an article, which I read it and it made me deeply upset and deeply angry and made me feel deeply trodden upon. And the story is, so over in Coventry in England this week, there's a legal dispute going on. And it concerns an Irish woman called Margaret Keane, who died in 2018, 73 years of age. Irish born, obviously lived in the UK. And Margaret Keane is buried in a graveyard in the Diocese of Coventry, in a Church of England graveyard, I believe, which is like a Protestant graveyard. Anyway, here's the issue. Margaret Keane's family want to have her headstone as like a Celtic cross, and on it they want the phrase in the Irish language, in Gaeilge, in our gréithe go jo, which basically means in our hearts forever. They want to put on their mother's gravestone in a churchyard in Coventry, in our hearts forever, but they want it as Gaeilge, in Irish, in the Irish language, in our hearts forever. But the Church of England rules are that they're very strict around what a gravestone looks like. They have to have a gravestone which they describe as fitting and appropriate. And the vicar signs off on whether it's fitting or appropriate, but if he's not sure, it then goes to a committee to see if the design for the proposed gravestone is fitting and appropriate. So the proposal for Margaret Keane's gravestone went towards the parish council, which is like, they call it a church court. It's like a court session where they decide whether this gravestone is appropriate. Margaret's family wanted a Celtic cross, okay, to honour Margaret's, the fact that she's an Irish woman born in Ireland, to honour her heritage and to honour, I think she was involved with the GAA, which is our national sport. And they wanted a Celtic cross, and they wanted that phrase, As Gaeilge, which translates to forever in our hearts. So the church fucking council, made up of English people, I can only assume, had a vote, and then they decided, it was 6-5 in favour. Yes, you can have a gravestone that's in the shape of a Celtic cross to honour Margaret's Irish heritage, that's fine. However, we can't allow you to have the inscription in anything other than English. And if you are to have the inscription in Irish, you must include a translation in English. And her family were like, fuck that. No, it'd be too cluttered. It'd look ugly. Why can't we just, she's Irish. Why can't we have the inscription in our hearts forever, As Gaeilge? So the situation went to church court. I don't know what church court is, but what I can say is they used an actual real judge. So an actual judge of the law was used to arbitrate this thing. So I'm assuming it's some type of internal law thing, but if they're using a real actual judge, it must be serious. It must actually hold some weight, even though it's within the church. So the judge, his name is Eyre, E-Y-R-E. So here's the bit that's quite difficult to process and swallow in 2020. So the judge, who's also a judge in actual courts, in criminal cases, here's the judge's verdict, here's his actual words, quoting. It is clearly right that the memorial to Mrs. Keane should record and celebrate her Irish heritage and her dedicated community service through the GAA. The inclusion of words in a language other than English has caused me rather greater difficulty. Questions of language can raise intense feelings. Not only would the message of the inscription not be understood, but there is a risk of it being misunderstood. Given the passions and feelings connected with the use of Irish Gaelic, there is a sad risk that the phrase would be regarded as some form of slogan, or that its inclusion without translation would of itself be seen as a political statement. So I'm now going to translate that dour, tiffin-crumbed, passive-aggressive English judge's words in that tone that we are so familiar with. I'm going to translate that into Hiberno English. And what he basically said was, I don't give a fuck if your ma is 72. You're not putting your stupid, bog-trotting, backward, savage Irish language on a gravestone. And you know why? Because when I hear something Cree, whatever the fuck you're saying, all I hear is Chuckygar Law. I just hear the IRA shouting Chuckygar Law before they blow Buckingham Palace to bits. And I don't want your terrorist language and terrorist slogans on the grave, on this wonderful, beautiful English country graveyard. Why would we want Irish backwards terrorism on our graveyards? Why would you even suggest that? So, no, go fuck yourself. Go bury your man a bog and preserve it in whiskey or whatever it is the fuck you do over there. And I know there's a few hundred thousand Irish people listening to this podcast this morning. And collectively, I can hear your teeth gritting with anger. Because of just how wrong that situation is. And the thing is, with the anger that we're all feeling right now when we hear this, it's more than a regular anger. That's a deep generational hurt that crawls from your feet all the way up your body to your head. It's an anger, hurt and pain that you feel for every person you love who looks and sounds like you. And everyone who has gone before you, your ancestors, who were brutalized at the hands of that very same type of ignorant colonial arrogance. I don't think that vicar in his mind, or sorry, that judge in his head was being vicious or being rude or being mean. I don't think he believed that. I think he truly believed he was right. But what that is right there, like, it's off the fucking scales. It's so stupid isn't the word. Ignorant isn't the word. What the word is right there is privilege. That right there is a phenomenal level of fucking privilege. Okay? It's more than stupid. It's more than ignorant. It's a systemic privilege that comes from a power so great and high that they can't see down. And also, this person is a fucking judge of 62 years of age who's been a practicing judge for a long time. And this seemingly educated a judge is unable to look at the Irish language, a fucking an entire language with a massive vocabulary that can be used to express words and feelings and emotions. And he's unable to associate this language with anything other then he's only ever heard a couple of phrases and words in language, in the Irish language. Most likely, Chucky Garlaw and other Irish language phrases that the IRA would have used in their time, because he's a judge. So when he, in his career, when he was looking through papers and pages and dealing with people in the IRA, that's the only context he has for Gaelic, and he can't remove it. And this, they just want to put in our hearts forever, in Irish, on our fucking gravestone. And this man's privilege and power is so high and mighty and so far removed from the subject that he is arrogantly making a decision that seems unbelievably ignorant and stupid. And that right there is privilege. That's what fucking privilege is. And for me, when I heard it, the complexity of emotions that I hear is, I tell you, the shittiest thing about it is my first emotion of anger was to identify with the horrible stereotype of Irishness that this man had in his head. My first emotion of anger was, it's like, how dare you associate the Irish language only with your perception as an English judge of criminality and terrorism and bombs. He is this innocent Irish family who are mourning for their 73-year-old mother. He is calling them terrorists and telling them that they want to put a terrorist slogan, despite actual facts that are presented to a fucking judge. He's calling them terrorists and saying, don't put terrorism on a gravestone, you silly fucking Mick. And the anger I felt when I first read it, like I said, it's unlike any other fucking anger. It goes through me through generations. And the saddest part is my knee-jerk reaction, and this is the real toxic part, my knee-jerk reaction was to identify with what he was calling us. So my initial irrational knee-jerk emotional reaction was, well, let's all fucking join the IRA then. That was the first thing that came into my head, until I squashed that and said, no, that's ridiculous. But that generational anger of the fight against British colonialism and all the effort to get rid of them, and my own fucking grandfather that was in the IRA 100 years ago, it all comes right back up and you identify with it, even though he's so fucking wrong. And that's my reaction. I'm from fucking Limerick, from the south. I've never seen a British soldier in my life. I just have stories that were handed down to me. What about someone my age from Belfast, who as a child remembers actual fucking British soldiers pointing guns at their parents, who remembers rubber bullets flying in the windows of their houses, or have aunts and uncles that were murdered by the British soldiers? What's it like for them? People who've witnessed brutal marginalisation in their lifetime. And then I'm hit with a second wave. Like that initial wave, that's irrational. That's the irrational knee-jerk reaction of silly carry-on, identifying with the IRA because that's what he wants to think I am, and stooping to that level and stooping to that logic. Then you go, fuck that. Then the logical part of my brain comes in and I feel another type of anger, which is tinged with an injustice and sadness, because I think, this man's a judge. This man is a judge with a long career. Now, he's only arbitrating right now over a gravestone. And this is, you know, it's sad and upsetting and hugely disrespectful. But this man's a judge. So how many Irish people are in jail because this man's privilege and prejudice is so far beyond his capacity to see actual facts? This is fucking dangerous, man. Who's rotting in a jail because of him? Who has been called a terrorist because of him? And then you think of the Guildford fucking four, who were simply four innocent Irish people who were sent to jail for 16 years in the 70s for the simple crime of being Irish in London. There was an IRA bomb, and they just found four Irish people and pinned the blame on them because they're dirty paddy Micks. They're fucking bog-trotting Micks, and they fucked them in jail for 16 years because doesn't matter if they did the bomb or not. They're just fucking paddies. They're probably in the IRA anyway. And hearing this man talk about the gravestone and making this choice in 2020 and looking at his career of being a judge and the level of blinding injustice and not just anger but a deep hurt and understanding that hurt, when I get it, I understand it deeply through timelines of fucking history. It's not just the Guildford Four and that injustice from the 70s. It's going 800 years back. It's going back to the 1300s with the British aristocracy deliberately trying to eradicate the Irish language, deliberately trying to steal and eradicate our customs, punishable by death, to destroy our culture and our identity, to make us like them and to ethnically cleanse us for 800 fucking years. And it goes back deep and deep and deep. And I can feel and experience and know every shred of this pain in the fucking moment reading an inconsequential story about a gravestone. And I shared that on Twitter. And it got tons of likes and retweets from furious Irish people. Not just my kind of followers who are left-leaning and would be sympathetic towards Black Lives Matter, but it got shared by like Daz and Irish nationalists and people who are otherwise kind of being racist towards Black Lives Matter. And I shared the story and it made people rightly fucking angry, because you don't want to read about that in 2020 as an Irish person. But then I said afterwards on the tweet underneath, if this small marginalisation made you angry and you understood the deep historical context of why it's hurtful and wrong, then please listen to and believe others who are speaking about their much more immediate and violent marginalisations at the very moment, at this very moment. You can't listen to that story I just told you as an Irish person and feel all the anger that came up, and an anger that's associated with your history, and then pass judgment on a black person in America right now who's out protesting in the street, or who's so angry that they're fucking setting fire to a car, setting fire to a police car. You don't get to feel that fucking anger over that gravestone and then be angry or dismissive or judgmental of those people. You have to use the pain that you felt over that gravestone, that's your little key of empathy, to get some small, tiny glimpse of what those people are going through when they see something like the murder of fucking George Floyd on camera. Because here's the difference, lads. I got that angry over a story that does not even marginalise me right now. That gravestone story, it's offensive, it's hurtful. It doesn't marginalise me. I'm not unsafe because of that dumb prick making his decision about a gravestone. His decision isn't, I don't know, maybe if I go over to fucking Coventry and I decide to shoplift some deodorant and boots and then I find myself in front of that judge, I might get a harsher sentence because he's got a problem with paddies. Highly unlikely though. But that story doesn't marginalise me. In America, black people are getting shot, are getting shot and killed and murdered and their necks stepped on by policemen frequently and regularly, and it's a pattern. And that's just one aspect of the marginalisation, not including poverty, lack of healthcare, a complete structural inequality that bears down, the fact that civil rights, if you could call it that, were only achieved in the 60s. The fact that slavery is 400 years old. The fact that the Jim Crow laws, which came after slavery, which were incredibly racist, segregationist laws, that they only started ending in the 1960s in the south of the United States of America. The pain you felt for that gravestone is fucking nothing. Nothing in comparison to the pain that a black person is feeling right now in America, and the anger and all of those. So all those feelings are fucking valid. And you have to when listen to those people speak about their fucking experiences, and when you find yourself doubting and not believing someone's pain because you don't understand it, the reason we don't understand it, the same way that stupid fucking judge and his mad privilege has him conflating an entire language with the IRA. That privilege is the same thing that has us not believing and ignoring someone else when they speak about their marginalisation. It's the same thing. We're that judge in that moment because we benefit from the system of whiteness. So how could we have access to see that marginalisation? And it's not just African Americans, black people in America that are experiencing the pain. It's black people in Ireland. Black people in Ireland are very upset and angry about this. There was a Black Lives Matter protest organised in Dublin there the other day, which had a good turnout. The Gardaí decide they're going to arrest and investigate the organisers, who are three Irish black people. I didn't see them fucking arresting anyone when the Irish alt-right conspiracy theorists were doing their mad fucking protest during social distancing there a couple of weeks back, you know. But it's not just about using opportunities like that for empathy to listen to African Americans, listen to Irish black people, listen to people who speak about their experiences in direct provision. One problem I see with Irish people and their attitude towards America, because America is so very explicitly and clearly brutal and racist, because like we're talking about people being murdered, black people being murdered by police, Irish people sometimes can look at that and they can say, fuck it, man, it's terrible over in America, isn't it? Jesus, they're a fucked up country. That's real racism, that is. And Irish people will use the extreme spectacle of American police brutality as a way to minimise the experiences of Irish people here. So they will say, oh, direct provision isn't racist. Sure, aren't they given a roof over their head? How can you compare that to what's going on in America? And so instead of, they think they're actually empathising with what's happening in America, and it's like they're not. They're going, that's real racism. The racism that you as a black Irish person are expressing to me, I don't view that as racism because I as a white person don't think that it's as bad as over there, so I'm not going to listen to you. And that's unacceptable as well. There's a lot of black Irish people speaking about the racism that they've experienced since they were kids, speaking about racism that they experienced from the Gardaí. You got to listen to that as well. That too is fucking valid, and it's painful. Because Irish people like to think, sure, how can we be racist? We're Irish. Aren't we the blacks of Europe? Which is one of the most harmful fucking sentences that was ever spoken. I don't know where it came from. I think it might have been a Roddy Doyle book. It was in The Snapper. Irish people saying that. But like, that's the other thing as well. Jesus Christ, our 800 years of fucking oppression does not make it okay for us to be racist or give us a free pass, because now we're free people with fucking tons of privilege that our skin affords us, so we don't get that anymore. And in Ireland we have direct provision. Direct provision is a deeply, deeply inhumane system whereby asylum seekers are essentially imprisoned, right? And not allowed to work and not allowed to leave, and they're kept in it for 18 years. If you want to hear about it, I've got a podcast where I speak to Ellie Kiziombe, who is someone who's been living in direct provision for 18 years, and she's also an activist, if you want to hear her words speaking about the system. So direct provision is a racist system in Ireland. It is systemic oppression. We pay for it with our tax. Not only is it systemic oppression, it's systemic oppression for private gain. There's a lot of money to be made from direct provision. It's a private industry. The government are taking our taxes and they've figured out a way to make systemic misery a profitable product that can be milked. That's how fucked up direct provision is. There's also, and that's very uncomfortable for Irish people to speak about and to think about, because what we've managed to do with direct provision, it's the same shit we did with Magdalen Laundries. You take that injustice, that systemic injustice and pain, and you put it in an institution behind high walls so that all of us can say, I don't really know what's happening in there. I guess it's something bad, but I'm not sure. And it's a way for us to protect ourselves in 10 years' time when the facts come out, when we can go, we can just say, oh, I didn't know. Didn't know it was behind some high walls. We've done that shit before, but fuck the Magdalen Laundries. We can't do it again. You have to listen to the travelling community when they speak out about the racism that they experience. Irish travellers are identified as an ethnic group in Ireland, and it's the one truly socially acceptable form of racism. Most Irish people, even if they hold deeply racist views, most Irish people will never say the N-word out loud or would never feel free to use it online. But you bring up Irish travellers, they don't give a fuck. They'll say what they want about Irish travellers. No bother. Say the most horrible, dehumanising things in the world. And the Irish traveller thing, for me, I've so many blind spots around it. It's, since I was a child in school, I was in school with Irish travellers and they were treated differently since I was 3 years of age. I'm there as a little child in school, and there's these other students in the class, and this is the fucking 90s. There's other little kids in the class, and these kids are travellers, and the teacher brings them into the class at a different time to everybody else and sits them in a different section to everybody else, and they have different school books than we do and speaks to them very differently to the rest of us, which is a tone of patronising contempt with a bit of fear in there. And from the age of 3, because I'm a child, a blank slate, I just learned that, like, oh, the adults are speaking, those kids over there that are actually just human beings the same as me, that I noticed the teachers treating them completely differently to me and treating them as lesser to me, so therefore they must be less than me. And I can't speak for everyone, but that's the experience I was raised with. So I have to process all of that, and the blind spots come up in me all the time. And when I say a blind spot is, it's when your privilege, it's when your privilege prevents you from experiencing human empathy. Just like that judge in conflating the Irish language with the IRA. So I get tons of blind spots that I have to be aware of at all times around Irish travellers, because that's a systemic fucking racism that I was raised in to benefit from in the classroom since I was 3. And most Irish people had that experience. And you know yourself from my psychology podcast, the dodgy shit with that is, you learn something at a young enough age and it defines your way of thinking and relating as an adult. So then you have an adult and the adult is operating like, ah, I have some strong views about an entire group of people based on some incredibly toxic and dangerous misinformation that was given to me as a child, which I never challenged. Now imagine that person is a guard, is a policeman. Is that person, how is that person supposed to deal with the travelling community in an impartial way? They can't. They don't. And that there is an example of systemic racism in Ireland. I've yet to have a person from the travelling community on the podcast to speak about these issues, because again, what the fuck do I know? It's something I've been intending to do and would have been done at this point, but coronavirus put a dampener onto my live podcast, as you know. But that is going to happen. Something regarding the Black Lives Matter protests over in America If it's something you want to, if it's something online you're trying to raise awareness towards or be a part of. Just a few things that I've learned from listening to African American organizers about what's appropriate and inappropriate behavior online, especially as if you're a white person. Be careful of how you use hashtags. Be careful of using the Black Lives Matter hashtag. That hashtag is often used by protesters as a way to organize. So ask yourself if that really is the hashtag you need to use in that moment, considering how it is being used. The other thing is, like, post and share, but like I said, kind of aim it towards, you're trying to reach to people, other fucking white people who aren't listening. If you must say something, you reach that way. Use whatever platform you have to elevate and kind of retweet the voices of black people first, rather than saying something yourself. Be careful. If you've got followers who they themselves are black, be careful how you go sharing fucking footage of violence against black people. Now, seeing footage that's violent is traumatic for anybody. But when that person looks like you, when you could be that person, you have to be very cautious how you share that around the internet, because there's greater trauma. So if you see that video of George Floyd, do you really need to be retweeting that? Is that going to help anyone, or are you going to make someone's day worse? Is there another way that you can show solidarity and boost the message without re-traumatizing people? If you are going to use hashtags, use hashtags that most likely the people that are doing the oppressing will see. So if you use Black Lives Matter, you're going to reach people who are already concerned with Black Lives Matter. You're going to clog up the feed with information that might be used for protesting and organizing. So tag things that you think, like, the police will see, the American Armed Forces will see. Tag in such a way that judges, politicians, people like that will see. Use your tags that way. You're trying to reach the groups that need to hear this, because they're the ones that are doing the oppressor, rather than kind of preaching to the choir. The other thing too is, I don't know, if you're just arsing around hashtags and looking on Twitter or Instagram at the protests, and you see footage of people protesting, ask yourself again, is this the image you want to share, or is you sharing that going to end up with somebody getting identified and arrested? So just those little questions to ask yourselves. If you're looking for organisations in Ireland to support for solidarity, to either donate to them or to boost their signal, the Irish Travellers Movement, MASI, MASI, for asylum seekers. Then there's MERJ, MERJ, which again I think is asylum seekers and immigrants' rights. So they're good organizations to follow. If you want to listen to some of my past podcasts where I spoke to black people about issues of race, my podcast with Emma Dabbery, she spoke about growing up in Ireland, she spoke about her book Don't Touch My Hair, fantastic podcast. Spoke with my podcast with Ellie Kaziambe, where we spoke about direct provision, and my podcast with Spike Lee, where we spoke about the complex and often violent relationship that Irish America has with African Americans. So before we get into part two, I'm going to do my little ocarina pause. Now, I've been asked specifically not to do the Aztec death whistle pause anymore, because it's just not nice, is it? Oh, there's the good one. Okay, here's the ocarina pause. We're going to be sold some shit.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
That was the Ocarina pause. So, live streaming, lads. I did a full hour of live streaming the other night on Twitch, twitch.tv/theblindbypodcast. All my technical issues are now sorted. I am ready to fucking stream. I had an incredibly enjoyable 1 hour. You can actually see it on the Twitch page because I saved the video. I think it stays up for about 6 days. Played Red Dead Redemption. And what I'm doing, it's kind of like a podcast. You get the podcast hug from what I'm doing. Where it's me playing a video game called Red Dead Redemption 2. But I'm playing it in a very slow way. Where what I'm doing is I'm exploring a digital environment and trying to write stories in the moment as such. I'm interacting with characters and then giving them backstories, and it's just like a podcast. It's like a podcast, and you can, if you have an account, you can chat with me and interact with me live. So twitch.tv/theblindbypodcast. It's still a young channel, so follow me if you are on Twitch. I don't have a schedule yet because I don't know when the right time for me to be twitching is. Currently, I'm definitely knocking around on Monday nights, and after that, it's intermittent. If you've got a Twitch account and it's on the app on your phone, you'll get a little notification every time I go online. And then I'll work towards getting an actual schedule of when is Blind Boy definitely on streaming. I got some audio equipment during the week, which means that I'm going to be up and running doing live music on Twitch, which I can't fucking wait for. I'm going to mess around with that equipment in the morning. It's going to be so much crack. So that's the next big thing I'm doing. My Twitch live stream, which I'm really looking forward to. Support for this podcast comes from you, the listener, via the Patreon page, right? I'm twitching because I can't do live gigs anymore. I don't have any live income because of the Goblin of Strange and Uncertain Times. So my only source of income is the patrons and the Patreon page. So if you're listening to the podcast regularly and you can afford it, please give me the price of a pint or a cup of coffee once a month, okay? That pays my bills, it keeps me happy, it gives me fucking meaning, it means that this is my fucking job, and I don't have to worry, because this is my job, and you're listening, and everyone's happy. If you can afford it, you pay it, if you can't afford it, you don't have to, but thank you so much to the generosity recently, okay? Just thank you so much, and like I said, once a month I'm going to pick a person and you're going to pick a person, a random patron from the Patreon, and you're going to receive in the post a hand-drawn image that's signed as well. It could be anything. I might even say to you, when I pick you out at random and I give you a message and I say to you, you've been picked at random, we might even talk about what the drawing could be. It could be a custom drawing just for you, and I'll send it to you in the post. As a thank you to my patrons, because I do not know what the fuck I'd be doing without you. So part two, I'm still kind of staying on topic, but what I want to do is, I won't say hot takes, but I have some analysis that I'd like to explore with you around the brutality of the police protest or the police action that we're seeing on television. In what I mean is the response to the protests from the police, in particular how they're deliberately trying to target journalists, which is nuts. And I want to speak about where this type of quote-unquote policing comes from, because there's a bizarre Irish connection. So one of the things that's incredibly jarring about the past few days is US police literally firing rubber bullets at cameras on live TV. There is quite clearly, right, been several instances where the US police are deliberately targeting journalists on camera, and most people are thinking, why the fuck, why is that? Surely is that not a bad thing? Why would you look so vicious and authoritarian to attack the media on live TV? Is this not a violent... Everything we understand about conflict is journalists are unarmed and they're given immunity in any conflict zone. You leave journalists alone. In a free democracy, one of the cornerstones of democracy is journalism. And I think it's a number of things. Is it deliberate? Yes, it is a very deliberate move by the police. It's coordinated by the US police. It's coordinated, it's decided upon to attack journalists. And on a psychological level, it's an anger at cameras. Cameras, I've been hearing about police brutality against the black community for fucking years, mainly through the music of Ice Cube and Ice-T when I was a kid. I would hear stories about it. Then in 1992, there was the footage of the police brutality against Rodney King, which was a landmark case because it's like, here you have on footage, irreputable, police brutalising a black man, and it caused the protests, or what's called the riots of 1992 in Los Angeles. Now, in the past 5 years and camera phones, we've been seeing more and more of police brutality against the black community on camera, irrefutable, and it's ubiquitous. And the targeting of cameras, I believe on a psychological level, it is police, it tells me police consider, the US police consider brutality to be their actual job, and cameras are preventing them from brutalizing, because they now must behave within the law when a camera is present. So when they attack the camera, it's an anger at this thing which is preventing them from being brutal, but it's also, they're firing down the lens. It's a message, it's an advert, it's branding. It's so fucking American. It's an advert of fear and brutality. We are to be feared, you are to stay in home, we are not to be fucked with, and we will shoot down the lens through your television into your couch. They've definitely borrowed it from the only other place I've seen journalists consciously and deliberately targeted by a force is in Israel. It's happened for fucking years. The IDF don't give a fuck about journalists, and they'll fire tear gas and rubber bullets at journalists who they believe to be aggressors. When Trump first came into power, Steve Bannon, fucking prick, terrifying man who thankfully fell out with Trump and is no longer around, one of the most chilling things that Steve Bannon said, it was about 2 weeks after Trump had been elected, he said the media are now the opposition party, which is chilling because it's so anti-democratic. The media are the opposition party, and this is a huge thing. The vast majority of what Trump is preaching over the past 4 years, what he gives a fuck about is the media. He speaks mostly about CNN and complaining about and praising Fox News. He's obsessed with the media, and he really has what he can, anything he disagrees with is fake news. So you can better believe that this is coming from the top down, that the media are the opposition party, that they're to be attacked, that they're not honest journalists that are protecting the constitution and keeping people safe. They are the enemy of tyranny. And what they want, what Trump and his cohorts want, is tyranny as such. And the other thing too, you can bet that the police at the front line who are going against the protesters, they're the most maddest right-wing cunts that they could have plucked out of the force. Trump deliberately went about hiring people with very right-wing leanings, specifically for ICE, the immigration police. And this is well documented. He was targeting people who had like right-wing leanings to become ICE officers. So I don't see why it should be any different with the police. Another thing you'll notice about the police, and I think I might have mentioned this in a previous podcast, which is they're incredibly militarized. They don't look like police officers. They look like strange future soldiers. And they have these huge armored cars. And it's a very strange thing, and you're wondering, why are the police, why do they have these huge tanks? Why do they have all this armor? Where's all this money coming from? And something that I find really interesting about that and the policies of Trump, the militarization of the US police of recent times is actually, it's a strange little economic one. So one of the biggest industries in the US is the arms industry, making tanks, weaponry. Big money, not just big money, big employment. Now, during the Cold War, which ended in 1990, we'll say, the US was up against the Soviet Union. The requirement for tanks and weaponry was huge. So as a result of this, there were military factories all over America continually churning out military materials, creating a huge amount of employment and making a lot of money. Then the Cold War ends and you're kind of going, well, what do you need the tanks for now, lads? The fucking Soviet Union's gone. Who's your biggest enemy now, America? I mean, I know you need some guns and some tanks, but do you really need that many? Because Russia's gone. They're no threat. And what happened was, you have all these towns and cities in America where a huge amount of the workforce work building tanks, building weaponry. This is a fucking industry. So just because the Soviet Union collapses, does that mean now that the US have to make half the amount of tanks and lay off millions of people, of mostly white blue-collar workers? So that's not what the US does. The US continues to make these tanks to keep employment in these areas for people making tanks and making guns. And then they go, well, the Russians aren't here, but let's do a deal and make sure the Saudis or Qatar or someone buys 27 jets off us that they can't even fly. And the US continued with this model of doing deals with countries where, mostly Middle Eastern countries, where it was kind of tied up with oil deals, where it's like, you buy a shit ton of this off us, even if you don't need it, just buy it off us, because now there's a town in Idaho that has full employment, which has political benefits then for whoever's in power in America, and keep buying this military equipment. And as a model, they were running out of, they were making more tanks and more guns and more armor and more everything than they needed. So about, it would have been around the time of George W. Bush, but 20 years ago, they started to approach, they're like, well, the Saudis are after are after taking all the jets, and the Qataris are taking some, but yet we're still making loads and loads of tanks and guns that we don't really need, and now no one will take them. What the fuck are we going to do? So, but we don't want to lose the jobs and stop making them. We have an oversaturated market. What did they start doing? The defence contractors who are making all these things, they start going to the smaller police departments. And they start going to police departments all over America with their budgets and saying, Maybe you need a tank. I know you're just a police department, but maybe you need a tank or an APC. And you need a load of these guns and armour. And we'll give it to you quite cheap. And that's what started to happen. Police forces in America start buying all these cheap tanks, all these cheap guns, because the industry can't stop or else you have unemployment. And this is one of the primary reasons why when you see the US police on TV, they look like the army. They're militarized. Which it is, it's sinister. But it's not as deliberately sinister as you think. The reasons behind it are its economic reasons. You stop making those tanks and a lot of people have no jobs. And if you give people lots of no jobs, you've got lots of no votes. Another thing I want to speak about is the significance and importance of rubber bullets in these protests. And it's another thing where it's so uniquely, strangely Irish in relation to this current situation. Rubber bullets. Like, there's a lot of people, and this week they're first hearing the term rubber bullets for the first time. But if you're from Ireland, you've been hearing about rubber bullets since you were a kid. I grew up hearing nothing but rubber bullets. Rubber bullets were invented by the British in the 1970s. As a way to combat protesters or rioters in the north of Ireland. Specifically for the north of Ireland, the British Ministry of Defence invented rubber bullets because they were firing live rounds and they were killing civilians, and the optics of that internationally isn't good. Bloody Sunday, there were scores of innocent Irish protesters marching for their civil rights. I believe the number is 27, I apologise if it's wrong. Gunned down in cold blood by British soldiers in the 70s. So rubber bullets were brought in as a way to shoot people without killing them. Non-lethal. But I grew up, all I ever heard about rubber bullets was them killing people. Accidentally, they'd say. It was also a way, I think, to... Like, there was a woman shot into the fucking face with a rubber bullet up north. There's been people killed with rubber bullets. They say it's non-lethal, but I think it's also a way for... Another thing that's bad for optics is if a British soldier murders someone and then they have to receive justice and go on trial, that's bad for the whole British Army. But if you murder someone with a rubber bullet, then they're able to step back and go... Unfortunately, this person was accidentally killed with our non-lethal rubber bullet. We're so sorry. And it's one of the concerns I have with the current protest in America. Now, I think that the rubber bullets they're using in America aren't as big as the ones the Brits were using against the Irish. But they're targeting journalists. The journalist was shot into the throat last week with a rubber bullet. The third relationship, strange Irish relationship with the current protest, and this is the most... oddly fucked up one. If you know the history of the Irish in America and Irish Americans, you kind of have to use, you have to view the American police as a very much Irish institution with very racist roots, and racist roots that are based in brutality against the black community. You can go as far back as the New York draft riots of the 1860s. The Irish people, when they first arrived to New York, were not considered... Some say they weren't considered white. They did not have access to the system of privilege of whiteness. But they were definitely quite low on the totem pole of a system of privilege that would have been determined by second generation Brits. And in New York in particular, famine Irish, who would have been viewed as the lowest of the low, were living in the same communities as newly free African-American slaves from the southern states, and they lived together initially in intermarriage and harmony, but the Irish gained their privilege through acts of extreme brutality against the African-American community, the biggest one being the New York draft riots, where there was huge lynchings. And the US police, there's a reason why you look at all films and the cliche is that the cop is Irish. The Irish became a gang known as the fucking police in America. And that tradition goes through it. And unfortunately, when I see police brutality today, I view it as Irish-American violence, which is quite fucking shameful. But here's the real Irish connection with what you're seeing on television at the moment. So everything I've previously described there, the incredibly militaristic, aggressive, forward-facing, marching approach that the US police are having right now towards the protesters, the deliberate, the targeting of journalists, the full-on, this is an aggressive force that marches towards. That is known, that's planned, and the name for that model of riot control or crowd control or whatever you want to call it, the name for it is the Miami model of policing. And it was invented and pioneered by a man from Dublin whose name was John Timoney, and he was born in the Liberties in the 1940s. And he moved to America and became the chief of police. He was chief of police commissioner in Miami, in Miami PD. And John Timoney pioneered and invented this incredibly aggressive, vicious form of confronting protesters and rioters that we see today on television this week. So the tenets of the Miami model of crowd control, which were invented by this man from Dublin who was the chief of police in Miami, incredibly heavily armed, militarized looking police who act in a soldier-like marching forward aggressive fashion that never stops, preemptively arresting people, having mass arrests, having police officers in almost suits of armour, which makes them very difficult to identify as individuals, and also dehumanises them and makes them almost like scary, terrifying monsters. The conscious use of media, of so the Miami model of crowd control consciously places media, which is pro-police, pro-government, in with the police to act in opposition to the protesters and also in opposition to any media which is critical of the police or government. Not only the physical manoeuvring of how this Miami model of policing is done, but there's also an ideological element to it. Specifically, they make sure that they refer to the protesters as, not as protesters, but often terrorists, or they call them violent protesters. You saw this immediately, where as soon as these protests happened, the first message that goes out is that these are not the people of this city. These are foreign, deliberate, organized protesters, Antifa, that are coming from other states to create disorder in this city. And because it started in Minneapolis, and they started saying, these are not the people of Minneapolis. These are outside instigators who are anarchists, and they have a political agenda, and they're coming into Minneapolis, and what they're doing is they're creating riots, and they're causing disruption, and they're manipulating the poor people of Minneapolis into rioting. Isn't it such a shame? That's straight up Miami model, right? Another thing that with the ideology of Miami model is, you saw it with Trump. So what Trump was saying is, these outside Antifa terrorists are removing people's right to freely protest, and they are acting against the memory of George Floyd, which is hugely disrespectful out of Trump. But whoever's advising him, they're following the Miami model. They're making the protesters believe that the police are actually there to protect them so that they can protest. And what they're doing is the police are trying to weed out the baddies. This is America. Of course you can protest. You've got free speech. Please protest. We're just here to take away all these bad terrorists that are among you, these Antifa people. They're not here to benefit you. You go and protest. But it's all bullshit. That's ideological warfare. And of course, the deliberate targeting of media that isn't agreed with. Confiscating cameras, attacking the cameramen, that's all part of the Miami model. And there's also the use of non-lethal weapons. So it's a shock and awe type of thing. Loud bangs, tear gas, rubber bullets, terror, but not flat out murdering people, but making people believe that they're about to be murdered. So that right there, that is the Miami model of crowd control. That's what we're seeing unfolding on television. It's a post 9/11 means of crowd control, which is different, and was invented by a man from Dublin called John Timoney. And that's a fact. So that's another bit of shame we can have there. So that's all I've got time for this week. I'll be back next week, hopefully with a hot take. Like I said, this week it felt wrong. It would have felt wrong if I didn't address what's happening in the news, if I didn't speak about it. My intention this week was to not... I didn't want to centre fucking Irishness or Irish oppression in any of this as a way to speak over what's happening. What I wanted to do was to try and use it as a way to communicate a capacity and ability for us to have empathy for people who are being marginalised so we can listen to them. That was the intention of this week's podcast. Mind yourself, look after yourself, look after your mental health. Enjoy the bit of good weather while it's there. Don't get heat rash. Wear fucking masks in public places, lads. Look up the studies. If everyone's wearing a mask, if you're protesting, if you're going to a protest in Ireland, wear a cotton face mask and make sure everyone else does as well. If everybody is wearing a face mask, the risk of transmission of coronavirus goes down. I think it's 15% is the latest figure, all right? But absolutely wear a face covering of some description. Yurt, I'll talk to you next week. Catch me on Twitch.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Catch me on Twitch. That's going to be some fun coming up. All right.